We're not going to be turning paradoxes into a tilting plant, so that's not going to happen. And neither are we going to be teaching any scrapbooking lessons here in the class, so please relax on that score. Right, right. All right. Well, you know, both my boys are working part-time, and you learn things that way. And I found out from my son, who works at a pizza parlor / Italian restaurant, that this is the biggest pizza day of the year. I guess the football game does that. But my other son works for a video movie rental place, and he says this is the biggest rental day of the year. So there must be a lot of people who don't really follow football that have to find something to do. So, pardon me? They're in another room, another TV, exactly. So both of them are going to miss the game. I got a lot of questions last week about this Galaxy show I put together. And, you know, we made an interesting point at the end about how unique our Milky Way galaxy is for the support of the light. And so what I did is, you know, 200 galaxies is too many. I've really trimmed this down. But what I've done is I've actually gone through all the websites of galaxy photos I could find and pulled out those galaxies that looked the closest to our Milky Way galaxy. So it was a really short show. I'm going to begin with the Milky Way galaxy, and then we're going to see the closest twins. But I think it dramatically shows you just how different our galaxy is from all other galaxies that are out there, and why we can safely conclude that at least of all the galaxies we can see, this is the only one that would have the possibility of supporting light. Now, this may spoil your enjoyment for the next time you watch those old Star Trek DVDs. A galaxy far, far away just isn't going to cut it anymore. So, anyway, we're going to start. And by the way, what if you asked me last week, how did they ever get that photo of the Milky Way galaxy? Well, it's not a photo. It's a reconstruction. But one of the exciting developments of the past 6 months is a group of astronomers have actually successfully reconstructed what the picture of our Milky Way galaxy would look like if you were far away and photographing it. So what you're going to see is actually a very accurate reconstruction of our Milky Way galaxy. So with that, let me just show this. And if we could cut out one of the lights, that would be helpful. Or a couple of the lights. I don't think we need any lights on. Yeah, that'll be fine. Okay. Here we go. Let me start. False advertising here. Let's go here. All right. There you go. That's the Milky Way galaxy. And this is the galaxy that looks closest to it. And the next closest. These are all in order of how close they look like it. That's true. That's the light of all the other stars. Half the stars in of a galaxy, of a spiral galaxy, are in the center. So this gives you an idea. You can see just how many stars are jammed in there. Yes, yes. I don't know. It's one of those two. And you know, keep in mind that these are all upside down, so don't think you got it all figured out just by looking at this. Yeah, people in this class think I got answers to everything, but there are three today that I couldn't answer. So anyway, here we go. Let me pull this one up again. And the question, where are we?
We're located. Galaxy.
But as I mentioned last week, it's quite clear as you compare this galaxy to the other galaxies, our galaxy is extremely symmetrical. I mean, you can see a little bit of disturbance. There's some of the spiral arms. You can see some splitting, but it's nothing like what you see on the other galaxies. The spiral arms are quite symmetrical. There's a small bar in the center of our galaxy, but again, it shows high symmetry. And one of the unique features, another unique feature, is if you see these centers, those centers of new star formation are relatively evenly distributed throughout the galaxy. Notice that none of them are really very big. Whereas you looked at other spiral galaxies, you notice that the centers of star formation were only a few, and they tended to be very dominant. Let me see if I can pick up an example here of what I mean by that, just by way of comparison. Now, I can't tell by looking at this. Let me see if it's this one. Yeah, that's a good one. It kind of shows you, well, I mean, the spiral arms are more spread out, which is a problem because that lets radiation from the center get out. But you can see here that there are regions here where the star formation is active. I think I got a better photograph of this. Let's see what this one looks like. Ah, yeah, this gives you a better idea. Here you can see that this galaxy has some very active regions of star formation, and in this area it's so active it's actually disturbed the structure of the spiral arm. And if you're anywhere near one of these places, you will get exposed to radiation. But fortunately, if you look in our galaxy, those regions of star formation, none of them are extremely prominent. All relatively small and well spread out, so you don't get any disturbances of the spiral arms, any significant disturbances. And there's places where you could put a life support planet, like here, where things would be safe. Yes, Jocelyn. Okay, what you're seeing when you look out at a night sky where it's really dark and you can actually see the Milky Way, you're seeing this spiral arm right here, and then you're seeing this spiral arm right here. There's actually three spiral arms that you can see, but two completely dominate. And then the brightest part would be this region here. We're looking at two spiral arms. That's where you're looking towards Sagittarius. When you look towards Sagittarius, you're looking towards the center of our galaxy. And there you're picking up the densest parts of the spiral arms. But yeah, typically with the Milky Way, you've only seen two spiral arms. Yes. No, they're only looking, well, I mean, they are doing a search for extrasolar planets in the Andromeda Galaxy. But the technique they use there is what's called microlensing. And that's actually being used in our galaxy. So the microlensing discoveries are actually taking place in the center of our galaxy. And the whole point there is you want to use a star between you and the planetary system where that star acts as a gravitational lens that magnifies the distant planetary system behind you. In fact, there's a few cases that have been done where they get two stars perfectly lined up between your telescope and the planetary system you're imaging, and in one case they got a magnification factor of more than 100 times. So it's like having a telescope on planet Earth with 100 times the size of what we have right now. You can actually use these. But the only way you're going to get these microlensing events working for you is if you look to a region where the star density is very high, because then you got a probability of actually getting stars perfectly lining up between you and the system you're trying to image. And so one way they do that is look towards the center of our galaxy. Another way they do that is they look towards the center of the Andromeda Galaxy, the other large spiral galaxy in our local group. And so far they found four planets that way. 4 to 209 have been discovered through microlensing. But one reason for the focus on microlensing is that's the one technique that we have that has the potential of imaging planets like Earth. If you get, you know, 100 or 200 times magnification factor as a result of one of these coincidental gravitational lens setups, then you can potentially image a planet as small as the Earth. Have they done that yet? No, but they have found what they call super-Earths. These are planets that are like 3 to 7 times the size of our Earth that are orbiting their star relatively closely. By the way, that's not good in terms of trying to find a candidate for life. You put a planet that big in the inner solar system, and that will guarantee the disturbance of a planet like Earth that could have life on it. So that's one of the requirements for the possibility of life, is that the system be devoid of super-Earths. Yes, in the back. Yes. Okay, that bar is caused by our Milky Way galaxy absorbing dwarf galaxies. And so any galaxy that you see that's got a big bar on it, or even a little bar, that's a galaxy that in the relatively recent past has absorbed or merged with a dwarf galaxy. And this particular bar was probably caused by a merger event that took place about 500 million years ago. And so that just shows you that, you know, that kind of absorption can cause something that lasts a long time. In fact, as you look at these other galaxies, you'll notice that you can see evidence of disturbance. I mean, this is probably the most symmetrical galaxy that you're going to find outside of our Milky Way galaxy in terms of spiral galaxies. But you can see that these other arms have had some disturbance. There's a disturbance here where the arms are flaring. There's one right in here that you can see. And these are caused by significant merger events. When we go back to our Milky Way galaxy, we can actually tell by the high symmetry of the arms that our Milky Way galaxy has not absorbed a dwarf galaxy bigger than the Small Magellanic Cloud in the last 10 billion years. And that's really rare. I mean, that's really explains why our galaxy is like this. On the other hand, if it wasn't absorbing on a fairly frequent basis galaxies that are somewhat smaller than the Small Magellanic Cloud, then you would not be able to sustain the spiral structure. A condition for a spiral galaxy keeping its spiral structure is that it continues to have a supply of gas and dust. I mean, when our Milky Way galaxy absorbs a dwarf galaxy, the stars get swept up into the spiral arms, but the gas and dust of that dwarf galaxy gets sucked into the center, and then the spiral structure will force that gas and dust out into the spiral arms. That's one of the reasons why our system has planets, where we have an Earth that has a lot of heavy metals. We happen to exist out here, which is just inside what's called the co-rotation distance, and that's where you get a pileup of heavy metal material as gas streams out from the center of the galaxy into the outer part of the galaxy. So that's really the best place in which to have stars that could have enough metals to make planets. And that answers your question. Where do you look to find star systems with planets? You basically look about halfway out from the center of the galaxy. That's the best place. That's where you have the highest percentage of stars that are going to have planets. And that percentage isn't very good. It's still only 2%. So you want to look around the sun or somewhere at this co-rotation distance from the sun, just on the inside. This is where you're going to find the high metallicity stars, which are going to have a good probability of having planets going around them. You want to look at stars that are about the age of the sun and about the metallicity of the sun. That's one thing we've noted. If the star has significantly fewer metals or greater metals, then the probability of finding planets drops off significantly. So you basically look for solar twins. Yes. Oh, well, what happens if it's not absorbing dwarf galaxies is the spiral structure collapse and the galaxy will become what's called a spherical or an ellipsoidal galaxy. Let me switch over and see if I can find one of those for you. That, by the way, these ellipsoidal galaxies account for over 90% of all the galaxies. When the universe was young, it was dominated by spiral galaxies, but as the universe gets older and older, more and more of those spiral galaxies collapse to become these ellipsoidal galaxies. Now, let me see if I can find you. And here's an example. Where did it go? Right here. Okay. This one up here is a spheroidal galaxy. I don't have a lot of pictures of these because they really don't look that interesting. Just a gigantic ball of stars and globular clusters. But they typically tend to be a lot larger than the spiral galaxy. This is a spiral galaxy down here, about the size of our spiral galaxy. This is a giant spiral galaxy. And this is the dominant galaxy in this cluster, which is one of these ellipsoidal galaxies. Let me see if I can find you another one that actually shows you the whole structure of it. Yes, they are. Let me see what we got here. Now, that's a globular cluster. We may have one here. Nope. Hedgehog spiral. Yeah, I tended to pick the pretty ones. Oh, here we go. This is a fairly typical ellipsoidal galaxy. It's about 20 to 30 times the size of our galaxy. Was spiral at one time, but it has collapsed into this spherical structure. In terms of its dimensions, it's not a lot bigger than our galaxy, even though it contains about 25 times the mass of our galaxy. These two little things here are smaller ellipsoidal galaxies that are in the same vicinity, but this is the dominant galaxy. By the way, this is not the biggest galaxy in its cluster. It's the second biggest. This is in a Virgo cluster of galaxies. And all around here, you can see little tiny things, which are actually mini galaxies that are orbiting around this galaxy. There's hundreds of them in this case. But this is really what a typical galaxy looks like in the universe. But the reason why you don't see pictures is that there's not a lot of exciting stuff to look at in the way of structure. The spiral galaxies are considered to be much prettier to look at. But it does take a certain history of merging events in order to sustain that spiral structure. By the way, if two galaxies, spiral galaxies like this, were to merge together, they would probably end up as a spherical galaxy. In order to maintain that spiral structure, you need a galaxy like this that continuously absorbs galaxies that are anywhere from 10 to 1,000 times smaller than it. Yes. Oh, about a quarter of a trillion galaxies in the observable universe. So, and about 50 billion trillion stars, if you want to add them all up. Okay. Something we're working on at Reasons to Believe. I'll take just a few minutes to cover this. Let me end this thing. A couple of us astronomers, Jeff Zwirink and myself, are now in the business of writing a book on the anthropic principle, how we look at the universe and see it's been exquisitely designed for the support of life and of human life in particular. But one of the chapters I'll be contributing is on this problem of what's called missing twins. And the fact is that we notice that whatever object you look at, the one that has life on it is unique. We happen to be living on a unique planet with a unique moon orbiting about it, with a unique set of planets going around it, where that planetary system, a unique galaxy, is in a unique cluster of galaxies. And this is just a little bit of what we've come up with so far. And what we're doing here is looking at Okay, what's the best you can find in a way of what we would call a solar twin? And the closest star we found to the characteristics of the sun, and by a long shot, all the other stars, I've got a catalog in my office of 22 solar twins. But when you use the term solar twin, they're really nowhere close. The only one in that list of 22 that comes close is this star, 18 Scorpii. It's in the constellation Scorpius, and you can barely see it with a naked eye. A pair of binoculars might be more appropriate. But what I've done here is show you the characteristics of 18 Scorpii relative to the sun. So this is a star that's got 1% more mass than the sun, but because it's 1% more massive, it's a lot more luminous. The luminosity of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass. And so this means that this is a star that is 8% brighter than our star, the sun. And you say, well, what can life handle? Life could probably handle about 0.4%. So this shows you that you're about a factor of 20 times away from what you would need in order to sustain life. Most stars are very metal poor compared to the sun. This one has the property of being richer in metals than the sun. But the problem with having metals this high, 9% higher when we see in the sun, is that means that if you do have planets in that system, those planets are going to have the problem of being in the same neighborhood as a lot of comets and asteroids. The more metals that you have around a star, the more asteroids and comets you'll have. And this 9% extra is enough to give you many times as many comets and asteroids as what we see in our solar system, which means that any planet there is going to be suffering a very high bombardment rate. And any of you who have been to Arizona, there's a crater there that was caused by a rock 100 feet across, and it was about 20 times the explosive power of the Hiroshima atomic bomb. And it blew out a hole about a mile across and 350 feet deep. So that would be happening on a relatively... Now, right now, those happen about every 10,000 years. But with a metallicity this high, it would be happening every few years. 18 Scorpii has 92% of the age of our star, the sun. It rotates quite a bit more rapidly than the sun does. Its rotation rate is 78% of the sun's rotation rate, and its temperature is 4% bigger. Now, what all this means is that because of these differences, 18 Scorpio has an activity cycle with a much greater amplitude. And you say, what's this activity cycle all about? Well, you may have heard of the sunspot cycle. However, 11 years, our sun goes through this magnetic cycle, and when it's at the peak, our Earth gets showered with a lot of solar particles, which makes radio communication and satellite communication difficult. So, for example, your GPS systems may not work as well during that period of peak activity. But with 18 Scorpio, that activity amplitude is much greater, several times greater than it would be here on Earth. And that would certainly make advanced life possible and would make life difficult at certain regions of the planet's surface. But the biggest problem is that its chromospheric activity is much, much greater than it would be here on Earth. And part of the reason is that the star is slightly younger than the Earth is. And because it's slightly younger, it's much more active and much more unstable than the sun would be. By the way, there's a very good reason why we live on a planet where the star supporting that planet is 4.57 billion years old. 4.57 billion is when you get maximum luminosity stability. 18 Scorpio is sufficiently different that you're not going to have the possibility of life going on. And you say, what's the purpose of all this? Well, the thing that upsets me as a taxpayer and as an astronomer is all the money and telescope time being devoted for the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, when in fact we already know from the search for solar twins that we don't have any candidate stars that we can find. Yet they're pointing their telescopes at what they call solar twins, but because they can't find anything close, they look for things that really aren't very good twins, And but the bottom line is, we already know that those are going to produce null events. And you know, it doesn't bother me quite so much the millions of dollars that are being spent on this. What especially bothers me is all the telescope time that's going to waste looking for these signals that don't exist. We could be learning a lot more about the universe. Instead, that's not happening. Now, we run into a similar situation when we look at planets. 209 planets have been discovered outside of our solar system. And I went through the French catalog. There's Jean Schneider, the French observatory, maintains, every week he updates this, he maintains this exhaustive catalog of all the planets outside of our solar system that he's discovered. I went through the catalog and picked out the four closest twins to Jupiter. And so these statistics here are all relative to Jupiter. And the first one is HD217107C, rather exciting name in astronomers assigned to the star system. A planet they found going around it has a mass that's greater than 2.5 times the mass of Jupiter. Its distance relative to the star is 85% of Jupiter's, but the elliptical shape of its orbit, its ellipticity, is actually 10 times greater than Jupiter's. Now, what does all this mean? Well, we need to very carefully fine-tune Jupiter if we want to have life here on planet Earth. Because of Jupiter's mass, Jupiter acts as a shield, preventing us from taking too many hits from asteroids and comets. And if you were to make Jupiter less massive, then we would be taking a lot more hits. Or if you were to put Jupiter farther away, we'd be taking a lot more hits. On the other hand, if you made Jupiter more massive, then the gravity of Jupiter would now be sufficient to disturb the orbit of planet Earth. And we would no longer have this long stability of orbiting about the sun in what's called the safe life support zone. And you only have to push the mass of Jupiter up by a few percent before you run into a problem. Likewise, if you were to bring Jupiter slightly closer to the sun, that would again guarantee that its gravity would be too great and it would begin to disturb the orbital path of planet Earth. Same thing happens if you were to change the eccentricity. Because if you change the eccentricity of the planet, that means that planet will be much closer to its star in certain parts of its orbit than it would be in other parts. An eccentricity of 0 means that it's perfectly circular. An eccentricity of 10 would mean, well, this is 10 times greater than Jupiter's. Jupiter's is about 5%. This is a little more than 50%, which means that at certain parts of its orbit, it would be 50% closer to its star than it would be at other parts of its orbit. Well, in all three cases, this eliminates this HD217107 as a star system that could contain a planet that could have life upon it. The planet that's orbiting around it, the Jupiter-sized planet, has the wrong characteristics to make that possible. And here's another one that comes close. This one is 1.5 times or more. This is a minimum mass. And its distance is 76%, but again, its eccentricity is too high. If the eccentricity gets above about 6%, then it's a non-candidate. And if the distance is closer than about 98%, it's a non-candidate. And if the mass is more than, say, 1.1 times the mass of Jupiter, it's a non-candidate. Well, here's one that's less massive. And this is actually the closest that you can find. It's closer to the sun, but because it's not as massive, potentially, it may not do as much damage, but it's got the wrong eccentricity. Its eccentricity is too great for this Jupiter-type planet to allow a life support planet to exist with safety. But of the four, this one comes the closest. And then we have this one that likewise is too big of an eccentricity, and its mass is too big. So out of the 209 planets, we've yet to find one that would allow a life support planet to exist. So, in that sense, we've yet to find a star system, a star or a planet, in all of our searches in the Milky Way that would permit the existence of a life support planet. But that's something we're working on. We're going to actually be extending this to the galaxy, the local group, and all the other conditions of our planets in our solar system. And the focus on Jupiter's is interesting because we have a good chance of actually doing an exhaustive search for Jupiter-type planets. Jupiter-type planets are relatively easy to observe. And so rather than spending all this money looking for Earth-type planets, which is very expensive, you can only do it through space-based telescopes, a much cheaper way to go is to keep looking for the Jupiters. And if you don't find the right Jupiter, there's no point looking for an Earth-type planet if your goal is to find another example in our galaxy where life could possibly exist. And since the Jupiters are easy to see relative to the Earth, that's really the way to go. So it's just a little plug on how to do science without wasting a lot of money and without wasting a lot of scientists' research time. But let's get into our lesson for today. And, you know, we've been spending some time looking at all the verses in the Bible that demonstrate that there is this book of nature, and this book of nature not only reveals the existence of God, not only reveals the attributes of God, his characteristics, to a sufficient degree that we know it's the God of the Bible, not the God of Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam, but also reveals the critical doctrinal points of the gospel. What does the gospel mean? The gospel is a term for the plan of salvation that God has laid out for every human being. And so what I've done here is gone through the book of Job and shown you how Job and Elihu were able to discern the critical doctrinal points of the gospel without reference to written scripture. They were able to do it by appealing to the evidence in the record of nature. So this is a demonstration that just like the Bible tells us, everyone has an excuse because God has given us this book of nature, and this book of nature does clearly reveal the gospel message. Okay, now, we're going to do Job first and Elihu second. And Job gets an A. I mean, he does a much better job than Elihu does. But Elihu passes, whereas the three friends of Job that were debating with him in those early chapters, they all get a failing grade. Not one of them was able to correctly discern the gospel message through what they saw in nature. Well, which is significant because what we learned in Psalm 8 is that the key to seeing God's revelation through the book of nature is humility. And Job had that humility. To a slightly lesser degree, Elihu had that, and his three friends were missing that, which is why at the end of the debate, God pulls Job aside and says, Job, I want you to pray for those three guys over there. They need your prayers, and I will listen to your prayers on their behalf. Well, let's begin. So Job starts off, and these are direct quotes from the book of Job. This is right out of Job's mouth. In his hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind. And that's kind of the starting argument to show that there must be a creator God. And his point there is, there's life everywhere on this planet, but that life is something that's highly ephemeral. I mean, you know, what is it? It's one thing to put together all the chemicals that would make a bacterium, but what tells a bacterium to live? And if God were to withdraw his hand, every creature would die. I mean, his whole point, Job's whole point, is the life of every creature is incredibly tenuous. And if it wasn't for God's provision, literally his breath, then we would all die. And therefore, there must be a God. Or you can just say the complexity of the nature is so high, there's got to be a God to explain that. And then he makes a second point. His wisdom is profound, his power is vast. And he's challenging his listeners here, his three friends, to really look at all that God has created, from the smallest life form to the vastness of the universe and everything in between, the profundity of life that we see here on planet Earth. Everything has been provided for that life, and said this God has got to be extremely powerful and really intelligent to be able to figure out how to make everything work in such an amazingly complex system. And he goes on to make that point. He says, he performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be numbered. And he challenges his friends to look at their lives and say, can you not document that God indeed has performed miracles on your behalf. So he begins by saying, there are wonders that can't be fathomed, miracles that can't be numbered. This is clear from the record of nature. But he makes a second point. This is even clearer when you look at your own lives. And he uses that as an argument that God is not only powerful and wise, but that this Creator is also very loving. You gave me life and showed me kindness, and your providence watched over my spirit. Now, Job and the three men that are debating with him are up in years. They've lived quite a long number of years. We don't know exactly, but you know, most scholars believe we're looking at individuals who are probably 80 years old or older. And these are people who have been around the block a while, and so Job is challenging them, saying, look at your own lives and see the number of instances when God has shown you kindness and has watched over you. I think that's true even of those of us here in the class who are not 80 years old. You can look back on your lives and recognize there's certain instances where you shouldn't have made it, but you did. Something pulled you out. I think we had a little session here in the class when we were studying that passage in the book of Habakkuk, where we actually had a chance to share with one another just stories from our life where you say, you know, if somehow you escape disaster once, you can call it a coincidence. But if you've been alive for 50, 60, 70 years, then you know it's not just one coincidence. In fact, it's kind of a miracle any one of us make it to the point where we can vote. I mean, when you're a kid, you really tend to do really stupid things. But that's also evidence that there must be somebody watching over you, because rather than being snuffed out, you survived all those little foolish things that you did in your youth. But we do foolish things as we get older, too, and we keep surviving, yes. Most scholars believe that Job is the first book that was penned for the Bible. Well, there's debate over that, whether he predated Moses or not. And a lot of scholars also believe that Job may have been a contemporary or a little bit previous to Moses. We do know that Hebrew is a written language. The earliest evidence we have for Hebrew as a written language is 15th century B.C., which is the time of Moses. And so you really couldn't have the Pentateuch any earlier than that, because Hebrew did not exist as a written language. Although, you know, we don't know. That's the earliest record we have of Hebrew as a written language. It's possible it existed a little bit earlier. It's also possible that Job could have lived maybe 500 years previous. Some people think he was a contemporary of Abraham rather than of Moses, and that this was an oral story. I mean, if you look at Job, it's written as poetry, and it would be something that could be memorized and passed on from generation to generation, and then when you have a written language, it would be recorded. But I don't think there's any scholar that would claim that Job had access to written scripture. Well, I mean, Noah had remarkable spiritual insight as well. And if you read the book of Ezekiel, it refers to Noah and Daniel and Job as being exceptionally spiritual men. Men of great wisdom and great humility. Now, I think that's worth pointing out here. You know, here's this man, Job, drawing these remarkable insights about the gospel from the record of nature. But we need to appreciate he was also a remarkable man. He's not average. And as testimony for that, we can look at his three friends. His three friends just didn't get it. They were basically trying to convince Job that salvation was through good works. And Job was the one to say, no, you got your dead wrong in that one. It's not good works. And I'm not suffering all these calamities because of my sin. God's got some purpose for putting me through all this trauma and suffering, and it's independent of whatever sin I've committed. Even though he frankly admitted, as you'll see, that he was a sinner. He never hid that. But when you say, well, we don't need to send missionaries or evangelists, well, most of the non-Christians you will meet will lack the humility of Job. Guaranteed 99.9999% of them will lack the humility of Job. But, you know, you do occasionally run into people who get it all figured out without the help of a Christian or a Bible,
or any spiritual insight other than what they see in the world around them. But they're rare individuals. And, you know, Job makes the point, the pride of man prevents him from seeing these insights. Nevertheless, we have these scriptures that say we're without excuse because of how plainly it's revealed in the record of nature. And the thing I've noticed when I became a Christian, it was a whole lot easier to see this gospel in creation after I'd given my life to Christ rather than before. But the same thing was true of the Bible. The Bible made a whole lot more sense to me after I committed my life to Christ than it did before. There's blinders that get lifted off your eyes when you make that commitment. And I think in Job's case, we can say that those blinders were already gone. And as we get through this, you'll note that he was a saved man. He knew of his salvation. He knew it was a guarantee. And therefore, the spiritual blinders would be lifted from his eyes, where that wouldn't have been the case with his three friends. Okay, here and then back there. Yeah. There is no reference to Job in the book of Genesis. Okay, well, we can turn the lights on. We don't need the lights. Yeah, as far as I know, Job is not mentioned anywhere in the Pentateuch. So, yeah. Well, that's one reason why a lot of people think that maybe Abraham is a better date than Moses. The point I'm making here is that I don't know of any scholar that would post-date him beyond Moses. And the rationale for not making him earlier than Moses is the problem we have no evidence that Hebrew was had matured to a point of a written language earlier than the 15th century. And so people are saying, well, if Job wrote this book, if he was the one that actually penned it, and we have no evidence of Hebrew as a written language previous to the 15th century, that puts him in the 15th century. 15th century B.C. Yeah. So, however, I mean, if it was an oral recording that was memorized from generation to generation, then you could have him significantly earlier. Yes. Okay, so evidently one of the children of, who was it, Issachar? One of Issachar's sons, I guess, had that name of Job. Well, probably not the same one, but he may have named him after the Job that we see here. So, we don't know. No. You know, the only information we have about Job is what we see here in the book of Job. Yeah, well, I mean, if he was the son of Issachar, then you've got a lot of other problems with the text. So, no one's suggesting that he was that late down the line. So, okay, moving on. The creator, no, I missed one question. Maybe I did. Okay, let's move on. So, Job makes the point the creator not only is existing, and very powerful and very wise and very loving, he says the creator must be just and requires justice. There's a long debate between Job and his three friends about the doctrine of sin. And one of the comments he makes about God, he says, if I sin, you, referring to God, would be watching me and would not let my sin go unpunished. And the point here is that Job is saying, look inside you. There's a conscience there. God has written his law in your conscience. And the way the conscience reacts to every evil thought you think, every word that you regret speaking, or every offense that you commit, the conscience reacts. And Job's whole point here, that testifies that God is watching us every moment. His eyes never leave us, is what he said. His eyes are always upon us. He sees everything we do. We know he sees everything we do because of the way our conscience would react. And because of the way our conscience would react, we know that every sin must have an appropriate penalty. No sin will go unpunished. And then he makes this point that consequently, we human beings are falling hopelessly short of the Creator's standard. His three friends were basically saying, do good works, and God will reward you for your good works. Do the best you can. And Job's response to his three friends is, that's never going to be enough. How can a mortal man be righteous before God? God is perfectly righteous. We know that from the way the conscience reacts. And therefore, if we don't behave in a morally perfect way, then we are not righteous before God. We fall short. He says, how can I dispute with him? There's no point arguing with God. We fall so miserably short of his moral standards that there's no hope of winning the dispute with him. So Job was quite willing to dispute his three friends, but he says, there's no point trying to do this with God. I have no standing before God because of my moral imperfection. Now, what Job was able to pull together at this point was kind of a mathematical formula. God exists. He's very powerful. He's very wise. He's loving. He's just and demands a penalty for every offense we commit. We human beings have committed many offenses, and we fall hopelessly short of God's standard. But if God is all-loving and all-powerful and all-wise, he must have figured a way out of this dilemma. And that's... to figure a way out, smart enough to figure a way out, and loving enough to want to do it. And therefore, he says, this is the only hope any human being has. Doing the best we can to perform good works will still fall miserably short. And here's his comment. If only there were someone to arbitrate between us, to lay his hand upon us both, someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more. In other words, he says, the only hope I got is that there's someone out there that can make a bridge between me and this just God. Now, what's remarkable here is he's not only discerning the existence of God, but he's perceiving from the record of nature certain aspects of the triunity of God, that there must be this individual who is God himself and yet is able to make a bridge between humanity and God and to remove God's rod from him. So in other words, God has got to have at least a duality here in order to make this act of redemption work. As far as I know, this is the earliest reference by any Bible author to the doctrine of the Trinity, or at least certain aspects of the Trinity. Now, Job goes on to say that since God is loving, he indeed provides a way of rescue. And so he was able to confidently share with his three friends, even now my witness is in heaven, my advocate is on high, my intercessor is my friend. In other words, what he's declaring here, God has provided a witness, an advocate, and an intercessor, and all three are in one person, a member of the Godhead. And he goes on to say, let me just finish this. Even now, my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. My intercessor is my friend. On behalf of the man, he pleads with God as a man pleads for his friend. Some of you are trying to take notes. If you don't want to take notes, I've got this all in written form on a sheet. I'll bring it next time I'm here. And you can have a record of all this. So, and by the way, I'm not claiming to give you a complete record. These are just a selection of the verses I've found in the book of Job to bring out these gospel points. On behalf of a man, he pleads with God as a man pleads for his friend. I mean, this just reads like the book of Romans or the book of Hebrews in terms of how the person of Jesus does take the role of an intercessor. And Job goes on to claim, if I entrust my life to the rescuer, I will be saved. He says, if I make this commitment, my offenses will be sealed up in a bag. You, referring to the Redeemer, will cover over my sin. Yeah. Well, Natalie, I would claim that's not a contradiction.
without the Spirit working within you, you're not going to learn a thing from the Bible. Unless God spiritually enlightens you, the Bible will have no meaning or power, and you'll gain no understanding from it. And you know, all of us know atheists who have studied the Bible thoroughly, and yet they don't understand its message. The same thing's true of the record of nature. Without the Spirit of God working within you, you're not going to pick this up. I mean, one of the things we looked at as we went through all those verses in the Bible about the record of nature is how frequently those verses talked about the clarity of the revelation that God gives us to the record of nature. Of how you look, you will find it. But there's something within us, spiritual darkness, that prevents us from seeing the obvious. Remember when we were going through the book of Romans, we talked about the darkening of the human mind and how that darkening of the human mind prevents even people who are full-time research scientists from being able to see the fingerprint of God in nature. There's a self-imposed ignorance that comes over us. But without that self-imposed ignorance, it's really obvious, it's clear, it's abundant. The evidence is overwhelming. You know, and Job is an example of a man who was free of that spiritual blindness. Therefore, the Spirit was able to work through him, and he was able to pick all this up. You know, and those of us who have been Christians for a long time, we can look at Job and say, oh yeah, that's easy, I figured that out too. But it's because the Spirit of God has been working in you for so many years. And we've also had the benefit of revelation Job doesn't have. None of us can put us in the same category as Job. He's way beyond any one of us in terms of his spiritual insight and spiritual maturity. So yeah, as we go through this, we've got to be careful. Don't condemn yourself. I mean, we're not in the same category as Job. And don't figure, well, you know, why am I so dumb that I can't see all this? He was a remarkable man. And I think we're going to see the contrast between Job's gospel and Elihu. Now, Elihu was also a remarkable man, but younger than Job in years, and not quite up to the level of spiritual maturity. And, you know, he got it figured out, too. But it doesn't come across with the clarity that Job's gospel does. The elements are there, and you can see that Elihu was sitting there listening to this debate. And he saw how the three friends had got it wrong, and he tried to jump in and help Job. And he did help Job, because Job was being worn down by the debate of his three friends. But I don't know of anyone who has stated as clearly as Job has in the entire Bible. So I think you'll see the difference when we get to Elihu. Elihu, I think we can identify with. He picks up certain things, but it just doesn't have the elegance or the clarity of a Job statement. Yes. Right. Well, it's the same message. Well, you know, if you look at what Moses said about this in the book of Deuteronomy, he was, you know, inspired by God and knew that the Redeemer had not yet come. I mean, Job didn't know. The Redeemer may have come, the Redeemer may not have come, but he did know this. He was confident that God had supplied or would supply a Redeemer in one shape or form. And that it simply wouldn't matter whether the atonement price has been paid yet. If he put his confidence in that Redeemer, the atonement would be paid, or maybe it was already paid. It just doesn't matter. Now, in the context of Moses, he knew that the redemption price had not yet been paid. And so his last sermon to the Jews before he died was, put your faith and trust in what God will provide through his act of redemption in the future. Another prophet will follow me, and he will be the one that will explain all this to you and you know, bring about the act of redemption on your behalf. And so the Jews knew from Moses onward that the act of redemption was a future event. But they're in the same category as Job. If they put their faith and confidence in that redemption that would be paid for them, they would be saved. They would gain that salvation. So the Old Testament saints were just as much in a saved condition as we are today. The point is, are you trusting in your own capacity to save yourself, or realizing that without God, you can't pull it off? God's got to do it for you. So in that sense, you don't need to know that it's Jesus of Nazareth. What you need to know are these critical doctrinal points of the gospel. Now, it's nice to have all the information we have today. But likewise, I look at what Paul says, and he says, you know, it's wonderful what God has done in the past, and own that. but also look to what he'll do in the future. So in one sense, Paul gave the same message that Moses gave, that we Christians today will miss out if we don't have our eyes looking forward to what God will do. Right. Well, that was Paul's whole point, is what saves you is faith. And, you know, the Jews before Jesus, they had faith, they had saving faith. So it's what your faith is in. And here we see Job putting his faith in the one that can seal up his offenses and cover over his sin, the one that will pay his sin that he can't pay for himself. And so Job clearly recognizes that an atonement price must be paid, and he can't pay it, but because of God's great love and power and wisdom, he is the one that has done it. And he's done it through some kind of duality in his nature that makes it possible for him to be a bridge between God and man. Now, like Natalie, I'm just amazed that he could figure all that out without the New Testament. I mean, he got it nailed. Now, he also went a little further, and I'm going to close with this. He says, if I entrust my life to the rescuer, I will be saved. So we hear him saying to his three friends, give me, O God, the pledge you demand. Who else will put up security for me? He says, there's no other way I'm going to gain this salvation unless God himself provides this pledge that God demands. So God demands a pledge, God provides a pledge, and this is where Job discerns that God has got to be at least a duality in nature, if not triune. And then finally, after he's all done, he's able to say, my salvation is guaranteed. I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, how my heart yearns within me. This is the most remarkable achievement of Job, in my opinion. Not that he could just figure out the critical doctrinal points of the gospel of salvation, but he was also able to claim that he had so much confidence in what he discerned, he says, this is a guarantee. I know I have redemption. It's my possession. I have it because of the character of God and the act of God, and I will see God with my own eyes. He says, in my own flesh, I will see him. He's actually declaring a bodily resurrection here. Again, remarkable for a man of that time to figure that out. And, you know, keep in mind, even the Jews who had the Old Testament didn't get this far. It was the New Testament that made it clear that the resurrection is a bodily event. And he was looking forward to this. Okay, we'll close with that. Keep in mind, there is a meeting for those of you who want to discuss how we can be a little more effective in ministry here in the class afterwards. And we do promise to keep that meeting short so you won't miss out on the football game or the DVD you might want to rent instead of the football game. Or the pizza you might want to eat, exactly. So next week we'll compare what Job was able to figure out with what Elihu came up with. Let me bow for prayer. Father in heaven, thank you for giving us the privilege of being born towards the end of the human age. Giving us the benefit of all his wisdom and insight of these great men and women of God that have preceded us. And Lord, help us to appropriately walk on their shoulders and take the human mission that you've given us to the next level. To literally take this gospel that you gave to Job and his friends to all the parts of the earth. Thank you for giving us the privilege of living in that day and time where this gospel is literally going out to the ends of the earth, where we get to be witnesses to the completion of the Great Commission. And we look forward to, Lord, to that era, that realm in which sin will no longer exist, evil will no longer exist. And you'll set us free from the chains of the laws of physics and the space-time dimensions that prevent us from having all the intimacy and love and joy you want us to experience. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, thank you.
Your 20th anniversary.
Thank you.
Enjoy it.